Good afternoon and welcome to Transformational Women Radio. This is your host, Hannah Anam, and we interview women who are transforming their businesses, their communities, and their teams, and we get their nuggets about how they're creating this transformational change around them. There's really four key traits that separate out transformational leaders. They're incredibly purpose-driven. They are innovative change agents. They know how to engage their people, and they're very inspiring in terms of their core set of values. And today we have the privilege of welcoming Jennifer Dorian. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And just in talking with Jennifer, I know she has lots of great stories to share. Jennifer is Senior Vice President Strategy Development for Turner Entertainment Networks and Turner Broadcasting System. So I know you have this really incredibly impressive bio that is really long, but I would actually prefer to listen to your stories. So I'm going to read just a few lines from your bio, and then we'll get into your story. Jennifer, in her role, she serves as a strategic business and branding consultant for Turner Entertainment Network, which includes a whole host of really cool networks. So TBS, TNT, Turner Classic Movies, True TV, and Animation, Young Adults, and Kids Media Group.
Yeah, that means Cartoon Network and Adult Swim.
Okay, great. Excellent. So you've been at Turner for about 14 years, is that right?
Yeah, I've been there 12 years.
12 years. And then you've got lots of experience from before. Jennifer is also involved with the Women in Cable and...
Women in Cable Television.
Television, mm-hmm. Which is a group of... women in the media and cable TV industry, right? And you'll tell us a little bit more about that. And
yes.
And very involved in various other nonprofit work. So I'm going to just turn this over to you so you can share a little bit about your story. So tell us about, obviously you have a very impressive position at Turner. And I want you to maybe start at the beginning about, tell us a little bit about yourself, your story, where you grew up and how you got to where you're getting to.
Sure. Thanks for including me in the Transformative Women Club.
Yeah.
It's nice to be here because when I started off, I don't think I would have foreseen this. Grew up kind of moving around a lot of places and wound up being in Atlanta when I was 12 years old. Went to high school here, if anyone's out there, Riverwood High School. And was enjoying Atlanta as I had traded up from the previous city, which was Dayton, Ohio. No offense to anyone in Dayton. But I did enjoy moving to the south and to Atlanta.
But you're from Texas, right?
Yeah, and before that was Texas. Small
yes,
towns.
Yes.
My dad was in the media business, and we kept moving from small city to slightly bigger to slightly bigger to slightly bigger. And we wound up in Atlanta around 1982. And I decided to target schools nearby, so I applied to Georgia and Emory. When I got into Emory, I realized that, wow, this is a bunch of smart people. This is a hard school I got into, although it's harder now to get in. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I grew up. I was not purpose-driven at that point in my life at all, unless the purpose was to have a good time.
That's always a good purpose. Yeah, I endorse that one.
It should be the side benefit of college, I think, not the primary purpose. My kids are not allowed to listen to this radio broadcast. And anyway, so I was at Emory, and I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I sort of drifted around. I didn't even know, Hannah, what major I wanted to claim or, write down. And I remember my roommate was going to be an economics major. So I was so drifting and lame and not purpose driven. I was like, okay, that's going to be my major too. That's terrible. Mm-hmm. I was at a really wonderful school. Mm-hmm. And I wound up doing economics. And luckily, fate grabbed me by the neck and said, you better enjoy something about this education. And I took a class, microeconomics, which is the study of how you spend your money and how you spend your time. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with microeconomics, mm-hmm. and I realized what I was really digging
on.
So
you really are a nerd.
Yeah, oh, totally. they call me...
Falling in love with microeconomics, yes.
Yes, sometimes they call me Jennifer Dorkian.
That's so funny.
And in our corporate crew at Turner, I'm definitely the nerd. And I'm proud to be their nerd.
Okay. I mean, good for you.
TV people are known for being glamorous and yeah. good salespeople and good schmoozy. So I'm the backroom nerd.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, as I found that side of myself, I realized that I needed to go to further school so that I could now catch up with my peers who had already figured out that they were into consumer psychology and branding and microeconomics. And so I wound up going to graduate school, and that's where I honed my focus on branding, brand development, and consumer propositions.
And you went to where?
I went to University of Texas at Austin.
Hook'em Horns.
Yeah, back to Texas.
That's great. That's great. You know, I went to University of Texas at undergrad.
Fabulous.
Yes.
Then you have a strong allegiance.
Absolutely.
The football team and all that. Well, going to grad school, it was good for me because I'd gone to Emory. No mascot, really.
Yeah.
Again, sorry, Emory. But that was the beginning of me going on a journey, if it's where I am now on a transformative path, which was, okay, I want to be about helping brands adapt to change, helping consumers find the brands they love. That was sort of as much as I knew at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as my personal story, I think I set myself up for a hard situation. I went straight through from college to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And all my peers in graduate school had previous work experience. Mm-hmm. And so I was interviewing for brand type jobs at Frito-Lay, Procter & Gamble, General Mills, and not getting the jobs because they were more experienced mm-hmm. and people than myself. And so I was like, all right, what am I going to do? When I'm getting out of school, I'll move anywhere in the country or the world. I just want the best possible marketing job I can get to get myself launched on this career. And it wound up not being in brand management. It wound up not being in consumer psychology. But it was at least like a stepping stone near that area. And I targeted Pizza Hut, which incorporated. Because mm-hmm. some of my family used to say, oh, you work at Pizza Hut? Which one? So I learned fast to
What's
say,
the number I call to get a pizza?
I learned fast to say Pizza Hut Incorporated, owned by PepsiCo.
Yes.
And the reason you know why I got that job, I was willing to move to Wichita, Kansas by myself. No one else wanted to move. You know, not that it wasn't as competitive as moving to Cincinnati or Minneapolis or
Absolutely.
So I did
apologies to people who are listening in Wichita,
including my husband and all his. He's from there. His family. Yeah, okay. That's
the reason you moved there.
I'm skipping ahead. No, he wasn't in the picture yet.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So anyway, I go to Pizza Hut. It's the best job I can get in marketing. It turned out to be a fantastic job. It was new product. I was like an assistant manager of new product development for Pizza Hut, which was
a
great first job out of graduate school. I was but you know, it had its sacrifices. You had to move far away, and it wasn't the packaged goods tier of jobs that people were making a big deal out of. So I moved there, and I absolutely loved it because I had so much autonomy and scope. And I literally, as the assistant manager, wound up doing all the supporting all the concepting, researching of our products, the test marketing, the analysis of those test markets. Did the product work? Did it sell more? Selling it into the franchisees, writing the manuals for the point of sale, as well as, you know, what food to order. It turned out to be a great job. I was like the little GM of each new product.
Wow.
So I did that for about 4 years. I did meet my husband in Wichita. And we moved to Atlanta, back to Atlanta in 1996. And that's when I made a step, again, one step closer to what I really wanted to do, which was brand management, is I got a job at the Coca-Cola company.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I parlayed that is in my resume and interviews, I would say, well, I was working at PepsiCo.
Mm.
And I'm moving to Atlanta. Of course, I would tell them I worked at Pizza Hut, but it was part of the PepsiCo company.
Uh-huh.
So that at least got their attention. And I did not work in brand management. I worked in sponsorship, sports and leisure sponsorship. And two important things happened to me at the Coca-Cola company. One is I got to consult with 23 domestic brands. So it was like brand manager boot camp. Instead of working on one brand, I was going around getting to know the 23 brand managers on the 23 domestic brands. I had to know their strategies inside and out. Who's your target audience? What's your point of differentiation? What's your intrinsics, your extrinsics? Mm-hmm. How are you different? How is Mellow Yellow different than Surge?
Mm-hmm.
Which is still kind of a hard one to answer. Mm-hmm. And that was really a good boot camp for me. And secondly, I met a boss who has become my champion, Steve Coonan. He was very much a maverick at Coca-Cola at the time, who wanted to take the sponsorship business at Coke, which was hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mm.
Think about Disney World, the Olympics, NFL, you know. And he wanted to rationalize that portfolio and take the money that they save and put it into marketing at those very places.
Mm.
So guess what my job was? To filter through, out of the hundreds of millions of things we sponsor, which ones matter to which brands and which ones should we bring to life with what kind of creative programs.
Awesome.
So it was a really fun job. I did that for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then Steve got the opportunity to go over to Turner Broadcasting down the street from Coca-Cola. And he was hired as the general manager of TNT. Our stories are intertwined at this point because as he took on the job of general manager of TNT, he was challenged with taking a general entertainment, just starting to mature and flag large network, TNT, starting to experience softening results, and transform or you know, boost it back to a growing network. And they were onto the thought that they needed to brand it somehow. This was the year 2000, okay, when general entertainment networks like ABC, NBC, USA, TNN, TBS, TNT, we didn't talk about being brands. We talked about being general entertainment variety players. Serve everybody with something.
Which is, I mean, the whole branding notion is so important, obviously, in consumer products because there is so much variety, right? And everybody's looking for what's the right one for me. And so branding was so ripe,
How do you find what you love?
Exactly. And in the explosion of media and entertainment, the branding piece would have been obviously so critical.
Right, exactly. And they
that was a really smart move of whoever thought to bring, brand experts into the entertainment world.
And then source it from Coca-Cola with Steve.
Yeah.
So you're right. The cable universe had gone from 15 players to 300 in the time span of 1980 to 2000. So that was the business imperative was to find a brand voice, position or perish, we used to say.
Yeah.
So here's my big break. Steve Coonan gets that job. He works at Coke. He knows 100 brand managers. And he called me and he said, I've worked with you. You have good people skills. I think you have the brand nerdiness that will be appreciated and useful to us. Why don't you come interview at TNT and see if you're a fit with this team? So I met Scott Safon at the time was the, I believe, senior vice president of marketing for TNT. I met with him and I got the job by explaining how I broke down the brands and their fit with entertainment properties at Coke. And so I will just put out there to all the listeners, it took me four or five jobs to get to the job I wanted coming out of grad school. And I think that's a really big thing I try to share with everybody is, as long as you're on a path that looks like you'll have the right stepping stones to your dream job, then go for it. You're going to pick up so much great learning along the way that benefits you. Don't feel like a failure if you're not getting the exact bullseye position that you wanted.
You know, I think that's such a great point. One of my favorite Steve Jobs sayings is for his. Have you seen the Stanford commencement speech that he's done?
Oh yes.
He talks about, it's very hard to connect the dots going forward. But when you look back, you have, when you connect all the dots, it's so interesting that every single stepping stone in your journey has prepared you for where you want to go.
Yeah.
And so we all think that we sort of have a very clear idea on the shortest way to get from A to B. But, sometimes the winding path actually gives you unexpected gifts.
Completely. I agree with you. And that's definitely what I wanted to illustrate today when we started talking about, I started off with drift, not knowing what I wanted to do. Today, now all these dots have connected to where I feel like my personal brand now is to help brands and business leaders succeed with change.
Yeah.
Whether it's brand evolution or strategic planning for future business models, it's all the same thought process of here's what my strengths are, where I stand, what we can build on, and here's where we're going. So,
what a fun story.
That's how
story.
I got to Turner's doorstep.
Yeah, what a fun story. So, you're here now. What are some of the bold goals that you're setting for yourself?
Great question. Well, I think one chapter of that past story I want to bring up that'll segue into these goals is just once I got to Turner, we were able to, in the year 2001, relaunch TNT as the home for drama. So we evolved from a general entertainment variety, discovered our unique benefit to the world was that we had a lot of dramas, a lot of drama lovers coming to us, and we could build on that. So we shed and conceded certain things like comedies on TNT, wrestling on TNT, and we focused on yada yada. So the reason I bring that up, and by the way, it worked, and we had 22 consecutive quarters of ratings growth.
Awesome!
5 years.
Congratulations!
And again, I don't want to rest on those laurels because that was 01 to 06.
Well, but that's really interesting because it talks to the power of branding.
It established a success track for branding matters.
Yes.
So that's my goal for the next. My personal goal is I really want to be involved at Turner in making all of the brands we have world-class leaders in their categories, unique, focused, not being all things to all people. It's still an opportunity in the media world. And you always have that draw, the origins of broadcasting. There's always a tension between, hey, we need to be a focus brand that stands for something so people can find us, and hey, we need to cater to a lot of people so we have a big audience. That's a natural creative tension in the media industry. And I want to be my personal goal at Turner is to be an influencer and a contributor to how those brands stay focused, but still big and sustainable,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's economic great. Model. That's one of them. A second one is to prepare our company for the changing media landscape mm-hmm. and how we can be a successful incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
If you read a lot of the literature on industries that have gone through disruptive
mm-hmm.
technology
mm-hmm.
and their own transformative changes, the incumbents don't do so well.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
People, you know, 95%, according to Clay Christensen at the Harvard Business School, 95% of incumbents perish
yeah.
because they don't disrupt themselves. They don't cannibalize themselves. They don't plan for the future. They're very worried about protecting the existing business models.
Mm-hmm.
And without a doubt, TV is changing slowly, the TV business.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still so much great viewership and audiences and mm-hmm. money to be made in our traditional model. But we have to prepare for that transition, that migration mm-hmm. to a multi-channel universe. So my personal goal is I want to be in the center of that strategic planning for mm-hmm. how we're going to make that change. A third would be more personal. Like, I want to start to develop some intellectual property of my own.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that I can capture some of the learnings I've had into a book or teaching or blog.
Blog.
Yeah.
Yes. I like that idea.
Yeah.
I like that idea. That's wonderful. So, challenges. So you talked about your goals. So those are pretty big goals.
Yeah. To be an influencer on the brands
yeah.
and the long-term plan.
Yeah. Those are ambitious goals. I love them. So what are some challenges that you're facing or
you know, one I'm facing, I wish we could get people to call us and give me answers to this, because how do you, when you, your job scope grows, it's hard. You get stretched thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me, one of my challenges is, where do I focus my energy and where can I have the most impact? That's something I struggle with on a daily, weekly, yearly basis, is where can my team and I have the most impact? And there was an article in Inc. About the lean startup. I forgot the guy's name. Is Eric somebody.
Yes.
What a great article. I used that last year to write my whole strategic plan for my team. It was like, what is the one or two priorities that are essential that we can have impact with? So that's a challenge
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Another challenge is the pace of change. My God, you know, between the time we start this interview and finish it, there will be a new social media platform
mm-hmm.
that everyone's joining or mm-hmm. a new way to push out information, you know, that we haven't thought of before. So,
within the
crazy.
Context of that external challenge, what is the internal challenge for you in terms of the pace of, you talked about pace of change being a challenge that we all face, right? So how does that manifest itself for you as a leader?
Well, it's hard to keep, first of all, you're inundated with so much important information. How do I keep up with all that and
yeah.
be savvy? And then second, how can the rate of change inside our group and company keep pace with the market's change?
Mm-hmm.
That's a challenge probably for many industries.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, internalizing it. So keeping up, knowing what's important, adapting plans, especially with media. I mean, you know, for us, it's not just how to get the word out in a marketing sense. It's how people consume our shows.
Of course. Yeah. And obviously, I mean, keeping up with that pace of change in terms of hopefully staying ahead.
Yeah.
Reading the wins and staying ahead.
So that's
that.
A challenge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are great. So you talked about, one of the things that is important is this power of branding, right? And how you were able to create some really significant value for the network through really identifying the core
mm-hmm.
of who your target consumer is and what brand messaging and shows and products would really appeal to them. Okay, so let's talk about your personal brand.
Let's
do that. So how would you articulate your personal brand to somebody who's a new, like, let's say I'm coming in to work with you as a new employee and I want to know more about Jennifer.
Oh, sure.
The brand.
Yes.
Jennifer.
Well, hello. I've been named the drama mama in the past because I was, what do you mean that by that? Well, I was a person who got to help TNT brand evolve for success.
The drama mama.
Yeah,
okay,
so
not you personally.
I had to
being
mention
dramatic.
That.
Okay.
Oh, thank goodness.
No. Okay, good.
So, in case someone doesn't know, TNT's tagline since the year 2001 has been TNT, we know drama.
That's right.
And so focusing on drama lovers with drama entertainment has been one of my manifestos
yes.
for TNT.
Yes.
And I was 10 months pregnant when we launched TNT as the drama place. So I got called the drama mama. In fact, true story, on September 6th, 2001, my water broke in a meeting and in a conference room. It was not overly messy, but that's part of the drama mama moniker. Very, very nice. So anyway, my personal brand is, I think I'm trying to stretch it myself, is I've been known as a branding person, the best branding geek in the business. And right now, for the last 4 years, I've been doing broader strategy work beyond just branding, which has been about helping business leaders transform their business plans to be ready for change. And so I guess I struggle with it a little bit. I think for me, I want to be famous for helping brands and businesses change with succeed with change. Kind of boring, but focused, because I don't think I'm the greatest operator in the world. I think I'm fine at it, but I think I'm really strong at envisioning a future and helping people make the plans to bring it to life. And then my personal, one of my personal passions is segmentation. You know, what makes different people, what turns on different people in different ways. And I think if I was to rally about or rail and rant about anything, it would be that everyone's needs are not the same. There is no average. Averages lie. And you always get further when you focus on people's unique needs. And the new technologies really allow like-minded people to find each other and reinforce what they love to one another. So I also have some IP I'm thinking about for myself, which is that, you know, niche is the new mass. You know, it's all about adding up different niche audiences so that they can have strength in a in their numbers uniquely, not because something appeals to everybody. And that's a big opportunity for Turner. You know, we started off in the cable industry, which was at the time seen as fragmentation. And now we have hyper fragmentation with new technology. So we just have to make
it's
that
not broadcasting, it's niche casting.
Absolutely. So that niche and narrow casting is a business opportunity for us. And like you mentioned, because of the power of branding, narrow casting has a huge opportunity for the media industry.
That's great. So let's delve into a big part of personal branding. Where, you know, I talk about it in my blog, you know, personal, your personal brand is really a combination of three things. It's a sense of purpose that drives you. So who are you in terms of what is meaningful to you? The second is your strengths. So what do you bring to that purpose that helps you make you successful? And then the third is a set of core values that makes you unique and makes you uniquely you. So let's talk about purpose. And actually, one of the things that is critical about transformational leaders is they're incredibly purpose-driven. They're very clear about why they're doing certain things, and that helps them be personally very inspired by the work that they do, and and very inspiring to the people around them.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what is a passion that drives you. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, this
notion of... I
think
change is a big deal for me. I think making, I think if I had, I never have said this out loud till this moment, but I think a purpose that unites everything I'm passionate about is change for the better. So if it's evolving something for the better, or if it's getting the word out about something because it's worthy for the better, helping a management team prepare for the better. Like you mentioned, I'm involved in several nonprofits and sometimes they need to evolve what they do. Sometimes they just need to spread the word more. So you're helping them make the changes that are necessary to do that. That would be, I think, my purpose is to make things better by helping people achieve their vision for the change they need to make. The passions that are around that tend to be, for me, creativity and communications. I feel like I do a ton of reading. I'm a little bit of an insomniac, and I do some of my best reading from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. every day. And I feel like I've been reading so over the last several years. I've taken classes, sought out experts, and read a lot of books on creativity and innovation and opening our minds, how we can further our thinking. And then communications. How do you get the ideas in your head into other people's heads? So those are two areas I'm really passionate about. And luckily, working in a strategy development group, those are two core skills that I have to be great at or I would not succeed. One is help, you know, first one is being creative. What do we need to do? Where do we need to go? What are some fresh ways to think about that? And then the second, communicating in an effective way. So on communicating, it can it goes way beyond just public speaking. It's how to be a facilitator, how to restate people to people what they just said, how to help people with visuals so that things are sticky. I've done a whole lot of reading in the last year and training on visual thinking and visual thinking styles. Do you realize 60% of most people's memory is visual and from the visual cortex?
Right.
So that just working, if you are working right now on something with just words, think about adding a visual to it, whether it's a chart, a diagram, a funny cartoon, mm-hmm. a symbol. Mm-hmm. It will help burn in your message and help people relate in a totally different way.
Wow.
So, yeah, creativity and communication are two passions of mine. And then I think the third thing you mentioned was my values.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think what I've really focused on is in my personal behaviors is try to be open to what the other person needs, mm-hmm. not just what the way I want to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe in a value of people who are at work. We may have a hierarchy of power and decision making, but we're all equal in that we deserve to build a lifestyle that makes us healthy and happy mm-hmm. while still being contributing work members.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe in flexibility. I believe in bringing out people's creative talents and probably developing people. That's always, I mean, everybody talks about that, but wow, you get such a joy from seeing people identify what they want to work on, helping them work on it, and then succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, because let's
transition
to the people aspect of
yeah, and being what kind of manager are.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing illustrates your values more than how you manage. And I have the good fortune, I think, of running a really small team of people who do highly conceptual work. So we're not terribly responsible for specific operations. We're not in charge of how things go on the air. We're not in charge of counting every inventory, tracking commercials or every dollar. But what we are responsible for is capturing ideas, facilitating other people's ideas, writing action plans, following up on those plans, researching things, writing.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all activities that afford a great amount of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And also, throughout my entire career, I had bosses who were so positive about work-life flexibility that I would be unethical if I didn't pass that on.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, for example, at Pizza Hut and Coke and Steve Coonan, who I've worked for 16 years, which is kind of an unusual career path, but he kept taking on more responsibility and I kept having the opportunity to grow my career. So anyway, Steve has always treated me like a grown-up who can run my own schedule, my own life, and he just always assumed I would be responsible with my deliverables.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking. Mm-hmm. It got me thinking that the relationship between the employer and the employee should be like grown-up and respectful, not babysitter.
Absolutely.
So when I got the chance to start managing people, I would try it out in small doses here and there, and I was rewarded every time because mm-hmm. people appreciate control over mm-hmm. their schedule and mm-hmm. flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it doesn't cost the company anything to give that.
Mm-hmm.
So I got extreme with it around the year 2009. I had a team of 9 people who were all very good achievers. Mm-hmm. So I had a high trust level with
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And we came together and wrote our values down around it in a spoofy, fun way.
Mm-hmm.
I had just been to Washington, D.C. with my, like, at the time, second grader.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all about the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson and all this cool 1700 stuff. And I just got inspired one night and I was like, you know what we need? We need like this declaration of how our team is going to work together rather than adhering to old corporate norms. Like, why do we have to work 9 to 5? Where did that, is that when the sun was rising, you know, in Manhattan or something in the old days? Like, who said 9 o'clock? And why do we have
to? Well, these days it's sort of like from 7 to 7.
Yes. And then our mobile devices.
And then the mobile devices come on.
Never let us go. This is, yeah, I'll tell you what I believe in. I'll tell you this.
With us,
but
yeah.
I do sometimes to answer emails at 3 a.m, yeah. Unfortunately. We wrote the Declaration of Personal Responsibility, that the employer can relax a little bit because it's the employee's job to declare they will take a hold and be responsible for themselves. So it kind of goes, we wrote it like this. This is the unanimous declaration of the 8 employees of the Strategy Development Department. When in the course of work-life events, it becomes necessary for one team to dissolve the traditional habits and norms that predated them in the corporate world and to proactively assume leadership of their own destinies and create the best working environment, norms, and personal habits to propel them to do their best work and live their best lives, we hold these truths to be self-evident.
That's great.
And, you know, not to go on forever, but that we're created equal as far as having the right to a life.
Yes.
We're endowed with certain uninalienable rights, that among these are having a life.
Yes.
Personal liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
And at work even?
Well, sure. Absolutely. And so to secure these rights, employers have to provide outlets for creativity, for learning, a chance to make a contribution, for self-esteem and financial compensation. But the main thing is we cast off the yoke of tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's where we got specific. And that is we cast off conventions of corporate life like rigid work schedules, staying late at the office to impress other people, being bound to work at your desk, dress for success, taking a lunch hour. And we replace those conventions with our new work habits and norms that work for us. And they, of course, were telecommuting, working from offsite sometimes, pre-established flexible hours that you communicate to others and that are understood, but that are flexible, control over your own schedule, welcoming exercise during business hours, because God knows it's hard to squeeze it in any of the 24 hours, dressing for the occasion instead of just dressing for success, encouraging thinking time on your calendar, spending time with outsiders. That's probably one of the biggest things I could rail on about is we spend so much time in all our companies with each other, mm-hmm. that how are we supposed to really be savvy about the marketplace? Mm-hmm. And then the right to say no, which was the right to say no to certain meetings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we solemnly published and declared these mantras, and we did it in under the radar in 2009. And we said, let's do a test. Let's start operating this way and see if our clients have a poor internal clients,
yeah.
a poorer experience with us or a better one.
Okay. And so let's stop there. So you guys declared this Declaration of Independence in this little group. Did you check with anybody before
no,
you did that?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I already knew from working with Steve Coonan for so long that he believed, I knew my HR group, I believed that this Turner is wonderful this way. It's a very decentralized structure. It's up to the manager.
Mm-hmm.
So if Jennifer Dorian's going to say, oh, we will achieve our deliverables, mm-hmm. and this is the style I'm going to run my mm-hmm. group with, then I was empowered.
That's great. Wow.
And I think it was also in keeping with the Turner policies that pretty much each manager and each employee will work it out, mm-hmm. because there are certain departments that cannot do this.
Of course, yeah.
But there was nothing holding back my group. But I was a chicken because I did it privately,
yeah.
between us at first.
Yes.
And then we had such great experiences where...
So what was the experiences? What were the results?
Immediately, my staff took advantage of this.
Yeah.
And started sometimes working from home, setting themselves up with the right laptop, with the right access to the right servers and folders, et cetera.
Sure.
So we wound up being more productive, happy, high morale, very responsive. I had several instances. I go to sleep at around 10 o'clock every night. My boss is a night owl, and he was writing our group more than once at like 11 o'clock at night. He got exactly what he needed back in 10 or 15 minutes because somebody else was awake and had access to the server.
Sure.
So after a while, a year and a half, it was so successful that now we're public with it, mm-hmm. and we feel comfortable sharing it with other departments and HR and so forth. And there's nothing radical about it. This is in keeping with many of the management tools that people recommend for millennial generation,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How to manage millennials. Yeah. So I guess we were just maybe 1 year or two ahead of our time in that we were like, we're doing this.
Yes. And good. Well, so tell me what you said people were, you know, morale was better. People were obviously more engaged and, you know, it obviously didn't lower your productivity. It increased your productivity and responsiveness in the organization. How, as you started to share this now with, you know, what was the client experience and how has this, you know, how's your sharing been
yeah.
received?
As far as sharing the Declaration of Personal Responsibility, it makes other managers really anxious. It puts them in a dilemma, and I respect that not every job is or every employee has the depth of personal responsibility to take this on. Some people need guardrails for this is how I should do my job. This is the norms I should adhere to. So I'm just totally empathic to that and know that every manager has to deal with a different team and different deliverables. So it has been a little controversial, you know?
Yeah.
And then with regards to the first one, I think that because we're a strategy group that's supposed to be looking ahead to the future, having flexibility and looking outside more has been a really big contribution. We are the people that need to spend time reading the trades and interviewing outside opinions and collecting all that because other people don't have time. Their job is to produce.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
I think it's almost like there's no other way we could be effective in our job if we weren't more externally focused and flexible to do that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. Wow. So let's relate it to then, you know, the role of your department is really to be innovative, to look ahead for trends. So let's talk a little bit about an innovation or a change that, you know, beyond certainly this declaration of personal responsibility.
Was just, that was our internal
Which
stuff.
Is great. Talk a little bit about a change that you've led that you're particularly proud of, and how do you keep your group inspired to be thinking outside the box, to be innovative?
Sure. Well, several come to mind. One, I'll start with employee-driven innovation is such an important thing. Great ideas can come from anywhere. So we started a employee innovation program called Springboard, where anyone can come pitch an idea, no matter what their level is, to a jury of, we called it a diagonal slice of of the organization with different levels of titles.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, that was an innovation of itself, to have an employee-driven innovation program where you could pitch ideas and then get feedback and funding for your idea. But number two is the idea I want to share with you that I'm really proud of came from that process.
Mm-hmm.
So a junior research manager came.
Somebody from your group. Your group instituted? Or?
Yeah, our group instituted for 600 employees.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Great.
So this is not just for your group.
Correct. This is for your...
For our division.
Yeah.
So this among the 600 employees, anybody can pitch an idea.
Great.
That was the new thing.
Yeah.
Well, from that, a junior research manager in the, you know, like, let's track the Nielsen ratings research department.
Mm-hmm.
They had it read in a magazine over the weekend from, you know, like, it was called, like, Neuroscience Today.
Mm-hmm.
And she had read about priming, which is the psychological, I guess, effect or syndrome that when you're exposed to a stimuli before something else, it changes how you view the second thing.
Oh, cool.
No matter what. So we're all being primed all the time, intentionally or accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
We see everything in a context.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote down, hey, what if we actually placed our commercials in commercial pods next to scenes from movies or TV shows that primed you for that category? So, like, if people are drinking beer in an episode of Friends and then the next ad is a beer ad, it will be more likely to stick in your memory.
Oh, interesting.
And we called that advertising innovation, if you will, TV in context.
Mm-hmm.
And so... That was an idea that immediately everybody said, well, that would be cool if we help people's advertisements be more memorable, but that would be an operational nightmare to place ads that way in the pods. And that we wound up being major advocates for this idea and pushing it through all the operational testing, taking it to Madison Avenue, seeing which advertisers were interested, running a test pilot for a year. Long story bearable, it became a national product that we sell now.
Mm.
So for extra fee, the advertisers can place their ad near content that makes people think about, like, it might be childcare, mothering, coffee, whatever.
Great.
That's one example. Bigger innovations would come from strategies. You know, Turner Classic Movies is such a fantastic network, but it's also a fantastic brand. They are the experts, the keepers of the flame of why classic movies are important to our culture. And we maybe 4 years ago started recognizing the fan passion that people have. So we put together an ideation session. What could Turner Classic Movies do for movie fans besides just put movies and curate them on the air with Robert Osborne? And we came up with some really cool ideas. A Turner Classic Movies cruise, where you can cruise around the Caribbean or the Mediterranean with like-minded movie fans, seeing screenings, hearing from experts, seeing the classic movie talent. A classic movie festival in L.A. in Old Hollywood, bringing our fans to the Mecca. A marketplace online where fans can trade their movie memorabilia, an app that gives you a tour of famous movie places wherever you are in the country. You can look up, I'm at the corner of such and such and such and such. Have any classic movies ever been shot here?
Cool.
They have. Watch the video right now. We've done all these products, and we're now making a business out of classic movie fandom, not just presenting classic movies.
What a great, so these are all new revenue streams that you've created by really focusing and understanding not the product, but the consumer of that product.
The power of the brand and the fanship in that particular case.
Yeah, awesome.
So those are two examples.
And so you were talking a little earlier before we started the show, we were talking a little bit about what it takes to really generate and be that kind of creative creative mind. And you were talking that book that you read. I want to make sure we talk about that because it's
cool. Okay, great. Well, I had done a whole lot of training like with IDEO, which is out of California, or Insight, which is out of Massachusetts. And they all teach you some of the same principles. Mm-hmm. One of them being, you know, look at things differently, have an open mind. And that all worked for me. I thought it was great for ideation. But it was when I read a book called The Iconoclast by Gregory Burns, who's actually a professor and a scientist at Emory University today. He wrote The Iconoclast, and it's a book about how the brain of people who are truly maverick and do what people say can't be done has three key functions that other people may not be building, you know, flexing that muscle enough. And the three angles of it were, first, you have to be a unique perceiver. Your perception has to be iconoclastic, which means you see something other people don't see. So that did fit the IDEO teachings and the Insight teachings. I'm trying to think of some of his famous examples, but, you know, he says that novelty is a really big deal. You want to put yourself in novel situations and have childlike eyes as often as possible if you want to see things like a maverick. Secondly, once you are inspired by some novel observation and you have an idea about it, secondly, you want to overcome your fear and your inner critic. And he talked, this was a really valuable part of the book, and we had him come talk and speak at Turner, is, I guess, our amygdala is the part responsible for a lot of fear-based hormones and
It's the part of us that developed when we were like trying to escape lions who were trying to eat us.
Exactly. So the whole flight was
fight versus flight.
Thank you, fight or flight mechanism. And he talked a lot about that is constantly putting a governor on the amount of ideas you share with people. Mm-hmm. Just something. I mean, think about it. You're not going to get killed or eaten by your boss for pitching a bad idea. But we react.
Certainly not Steve Coonan, I don't think.
No, not usually. No, he loves crazy ideas.
That's great.
So if you, we literally have the fear response of an animal chasing us when all we really need to do is share an idea that we had just had. So he talks about that.
Awesome.
And how to overcome it. And he does a really good job explaining more about the fear response and how ways you can overcome your fears, whatever they are, sharing ideas, public speaking, et cetera. And then third, he talks about the best iconoclasts and mavericks have social intelligence that allows them to share their ideas. So he has, he'd be a great guest for you.
That's great.
He has a lot of stories about people that had one of those three things or all three of those things. And it really helped me realize as an innovator, there have been times when I might have had a great idea and I was too chicken or a time when I just couldn't explain my idea right. And I'm blaming people like I'm walking away frustrated that they're so negative. They're idea killers. Why are they being – when really the responsibility was on me that I didn't explain it in a way that connected with them. So
he's bringing innovation. A neuroscience approach to really doing what nobody else has done before.
Yeah, and in his book, I remember there are a lot of tips for things you can practice. So I like books that offer practical. And also Daniel Pink, A Whole New Mind, incredible book with a lot of actionable exercises you can do.
Excellent feedback for our listeners. I think that's great. So share with us then. We've covered a lot of good territory and a lot of great stories. Share with us if there's anything that you'd like to leave behind. I know that one of the things that you are passionate about is WICT, which is the Women in Media and Technology and Television, right?
Yep,
cable television.
Mm-hmm, Women in Cable Television.
And so tell me a little bit about what your experiences are. You're obviously gotten to a place that is fairly senior in your organization, and I'm sure have tons of runway ahead of you.
Thank you.
What are some enablers to success based on what you've observed about women in the industry or women at Turner, the folks that tend to really get ahead? What are some things that you've observed about them, and what are some practices?
Great. Well, Women in Cable and Television, WICT, as we say in our industry, their mission is to prepare women for leadership. And it's so great to have a focus on leadership. And they have a lot of classes we can take and forums to hear more and panels and support groups around leadership. So one of the biggest topics I learned from them early on in some training was called agency. And how often leaders have to be their own. You have to be your own best agent in this world. No one's looking out specifically for you to find the perfect fit for you, to have the perfect job for yourself, to be compensated fairly. You have to think about what an agent does. They literally scour the world for opportunities and then represent your talents and get the best fair market value for it. So they taught me the word agentic, be agentic. That was a great tip. And I have noticed the people that succeed inside companies I've worked at are good at representing themselves, their talents, and what they want to go after.
So let me stop you here, because I know that there's probably other tips you want to offer. In terms of being agentic, one of the issues that a lot of women have is promoting themselves,
yeah.
Right? So how have you seen women that do it successfully in a way that doesn't appear?
Yeah. I think you have a great question. I can name three examples of people, including myself, where we did the following trick. You don't go around saying how great you are. You talk about the need that you see. I see a vacuum in our organization around X. And I am a great person to help you think about and solve X. So I've written a job description before that addressed a vacuum I saw in our organization, pitched myself as the perfect person to fill it, and got the job. Another peer and friend of mine did the same thing, and it worked. So being agentic, I don't think means being bragger. It means looking for opportunities and then pitching yourself as the remedy. That's one way. And then I guess finding champions, finding advocates, you know, it doesn't have to be yourself that is tooting your own horn. It's great if you prepare the people who are your fans with what you want. Let them know what you want and give them some handles or shorthands to how to talk about you. Hey, have you ever met Jennifer Dorian? She's the person that did that TNT rebrand.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know that she also did Springboard?
Mm-hmm.
I would maybe be saying to a friend of mine, oh, if only so-and-so knew that I was interested in marketing around the world or whatever, you know,
yes.
Brands around
mm-hmm.
the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think working the network, which is, of course, everyone talks about networking, but having, I think, two things for networking. One is giving people sound bites that they can share about you. And two is I can't stand the networking it's uncomfortable for me, and I'm sure many people, like, oh, I'm supposed to go to lunch with so-and-so because they're important. That's the worst, most awkward feeling. Instead, I like to seek out people I have shared interests with, like geeky neuroscience. Mm-hmm. I found out the other day that this one person has a study on the return on investment of a marketing plan and the lifetime value of a viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'm totally going to call her up and ask her to share with me the lifetime value of a viewer presentation, even though I also just really wanted to get to know her
mm-hmm.
and find out what she's working on.
Of course, yes.
I think it's more comfortable if you pick an organic subject.
Great. Right. So that, you know, there is something that you want to talk about that you're both interested in talking about in
yes.
the conversation
instead
that
of
is a basis for connection
yeah,
for both of you.
Connection instead of I hear we should meet.
Yes.
I hear we should know each other.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So be your own agent.
Yes. Another idea is to act like you belong. Kelly Regal was on this show and she gave me that piece of advice several years ago. She's like, look, whether it's about dealing with higher up people or if you're in a very male centric social situation or whatever, don't ever go in a room and shrink and sit in the back row because you think the power players are going to be at the big table. Act like you belong. Go up, walk right up to people and introduce yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Sit at the table. At least fake that you're going to be comfortable and you know, have some social chit chat on. At least one item you can bring up,
yeah.
The weather, whatever,
yes.
But act like you belong. I thought
yes.
that was a great piece of advice. Women in cable television has, I think, there's seven touchstones, and some of them, they're just so excellent. They're like, be fearless, be inspiring,
mm-hmm.
purpose-driven,
mm-hmm.
Be a catalyst for change.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are what leaders do. You don't just manage or supervise when you're being a leader. Those are some things that have come up for me with WICT.
Mm-hmm. That have worked really well for you. So those are your pieces of advice for I think, the women that you've seen that have really succeeded.
They are agentic, and they act like they belong.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And they are, they live out some of the being a catalyst for change. Having an opinion, that's a big one, right? Don't be a neutral force all the time. You've got to have an opinion on some things.
Mm-hmm.
And
So one thing that I would love your opinion on, you've obviously been very successful at getting the support of sponsors. You know, the fact that you've had a prior boss that has brought you along over some period of time, and I'm sure that you have other sponsors in the organization. What advice do you have? I mean, there's a lot of research that is out recently about the importance of sponsors, the fact that women have equal or more mentors as men, but the big difference is that they don't have as many sponsors.
Okay.
And so what advice do you have for women that are listening in around how have you been able to attract the right sponsors?
Well, that's a great question. I was just going to react that I think the difference between a mentor and a sponsor might be what we talked about a minute ago, which is that they know what you want and they can represent your interests. Because a mentor clearly helps you learn and deal with situations you're in and reflect and all that. But to literally be an advocate for you, they have to know what you want. So I'd say how to attract or...
Well, the other big difference...
Make a sponsor happen is they know what you want.
Yeah. The other big difference actually around mentorship versus sponsorship is around they are in positions of power. So that they're typically people that are several levels above you in the organization. So that's the first piece. Mm-hmm. And two, that they're willing to use their political power to take a risk on you and to advocate for you behind closed doors or with other people to open doors for you in the organization. So they have political capital and they're willing to use it on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the two big differences that separate sponsors from mentors. Because mentors, you're right, you can learn from anybody, frankly, in the organization, and they'll give you good advice.
Got it. So to attract a sponsor, the first thing you would have to have is visibility or exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad, but it's true. People cannot sponsor someone they don't know exists.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to look for instances where you can build your visibility. And those typically come through either what Tom Peters calls wow projects, like, wow, that's either complicated, important, or mind-blowing project because it's so innovative. Or it could come through you are doing something that the sponsor cares about. It might not be a wow project.
Right,
so, like, I know a woman at Turner right now who is a mid-level person, and she is volunteering so much for and leading a lot of our cultural initiatives as extracurricular activity for herself, right? But it's giving her visibility and access to people in power way beyond me, right? Mm-hmm. They appreciate what she's doing. They see how she's approaching the planning and thematics and creativity in these cultural initiatives. So she's building exposure for herself. And I think that would be the first thing. They have to know you exist. Secondly, they need to know what you're interested in and what your strengths are.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be it. And then I think that for me, the sponsors that I think I have, there's a longevity to it. So it didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of trust and authenticity that they, to your point, they're willing to put their name on the line for me because there's a base of experience and trust.
So the advice to a younger woman in the organization might be around making sure that you get visibility and exposure through working on either the wow projects or the things that, you know, you care about and they care about.
Yeah.
Making sure that they know what you're interested in. So speak up, have an opinion and talk proactively to them about what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And the third piece you talked about is this sense of trust and authenticity. And really, you actually have to perform.
It's not a shallow thing
to have someone be
your sponsor.
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes time to cultivate.
Yeah. Yeah. You actually have to, you know, to be able to, they have to see you in action and performing for them. Otherwise, they're not going to put their necks on the line for you.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you. What a fun, filled, you know, I guess I loved some of the stories that you shared and some of the specific examples. And I wish the rest of the audience who were listening in could be here because you were like, you have this beaming face when you're talking about some of the things, some of your stories. So
a lot of talking with hands. Thank you for having me, Hannah.
It's been a pleasure having you. And I wish you great luck. I'm sure there's lots of new and exciting other new stories that are going to happen in your future.
Thank you.
I wish you great luck. And so this is Hannah Anam. Join us again when we talk to yet another transformational woman. Signing off.